Morning, we're going to open up the House Special Committee on Budgets, Subcommittee on General Government, Transportation, and Economic Development. This morning is Monday, July 11th, 2005. We're going to rearrange the schedule a little bit. We're going to quickly go through Senate Bill 311, then we're going to jump to Senate Bill 1084, and then we're going to go back up to Senate Bill 480. So very quickly, let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 311 relating to independent medical examination reform. Robin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill has already been through the Senate Budget Committee that added an expenditure limitation for the fiscal impact of the bill. It then went to House Rules where it was sent out with a do pass recommendation to the Budget Committee. I believe that the only action that we need in this subcommittee is to send it out to the House Special Committee on Budget with a do pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Krupp moves.
Mr. Chair, I move that subcommittee, as long as Representative Witt is not here to testify on this bill.
Thank you for catching that. Right. Thank you.
And Representative Avakian is here. I move Senate Bill 311 to the full House Committee on Budget with the pass recommendation.
311.
311. Representative Krupp moves Senate Bill 311-A to the full House Special Committee
give
on Budget.
Give everybody a heart attack, Brad.
With the due pass recommendation.
Wait, I've got a
With a slight correction, I should have changed that to -B because the B amendments added the expenditure limitation.
Okay, I'll amend my motion to add in the -B amendments.
So amended, and Representative Krupp moves Senate Bill 311-B to the House Special Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so move. We're going to close.
Okay.
We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 311. We are going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1084. And very quickly, we're going to go to Larry. Good morning. And then we're going to ask if Mr. Jerry Wilhelms could come up. So, Larry.
Yes. Committee, today before you, I placed before you a copy of a fiscal on Senate Bill 1084, which has already passed the Senate, a staff measure summary and a copy of the bill. It's still in its original form, basically this bill creates a 30-member public commission on the Oregon legislature. It's required to review and make recommendations on all aspects of the legislative branch, including the timing and frequency and length of sessions, legislative procedures, the adequacy of legislative facilities and staffing. And the commission is to prepare a report for the emergency board and may also draft and pre-session file legislation to carry out its recommendations. The measure directs that Legislative Administration Committee and the Assembly provide support. And this is a commission whose staffing was initiated by the emergency board in January. In order to continue it into a 507 budget, one of the positions is necessary to continue to be funded. An existing position is going to use to carry out the committee administrator role, and the budget for the Legislative Assembly that is also passed on the House and Senate side included funding for that position.
Thank you.
Gary's here to speak to the matter.
Well, it's our privilege to have the Honorable Gary Wilhelms before us. He's also currently the Chief Poobah or the Speaker of the House, Karen Minnis. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Gary Wilhelm, Chief of Staff and Speaker of the House. It's been my pleasure to have been involved in this issue from the beginning, I believe. There's not much I can add to what Larry has said, but I would say that the last time we had a similar organization that did an evaluation of the legislature and made recommendations for improvement of the legislative process and operation was in 1974. So that's over 30 years ago, and the time before that was like 1968. And a number of the items that were recommended by those two organizations did come to fruition, and as a matter of fact, you're sitting in one of them. The wings were one of the recommendations that were made back in those days. And so anyway, it's felt that 30 years is long enough. There's probably some things that we might be able to do to take a look at the internal workings of the legislature, and maybe not necessarily just internal workings, but the physical plant, the electronics that we use and so forth to modernize and upgrade the legislative infrastructure and the process itself. So we have a blue sky attitude. Yours truly is one of the co-chairs. The other co-chair is Judge Laura Pryor from Morrow County. I believe that's Morrow County, isn't it?
We would accept that, but it's actually Gillum County.
Gillum County, sorry.
Yeah. But there are sister
school.
County.
I'm sorry. Yeah, right. I thought Morrow County is Heppner, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. In any event, Judge Pryor and I are going to be the co-chairs of this group, and we have started the process in motion. I've solicited the members for input and so forth in anticipation of the passage of this bill. And it's, I think, a modest cost that's been allocated in the legislative budget, $133,000, to support this operation through the end of the biennium. Final report will come in November, December timeframe of 06, and then any legislation that's needed would be introduced into the 07 legislature, and with constitutional amendments, of course, going on to the... I think that would be the 08 ballot, I guess. So it's kind of a long-term project, but we believe it's very necessary and are looking forward to getting started.
Perfect. Any questions? Any
very
comments?
Good. And Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say I think it's time we did this. And the I appreciate the fact that you are going to consider looking at the physical issues of the wings. This having spent a lot of years in the fire service, these wings are fire traps.
We
need to address that.
Well, thank you. It's, you know, we don't need to talk about this all day, but there, you know, it really is a tough spot that you legislators find yourselves in, because the price tag to redo the wings and bring them up to code is significant. And in light of the budget pressures that you have, it's a tough vote to allocate money for a physical plant in this case, but it's necessary. And so hopefully we can take a look at that and come up with some good recommendations that will help you out.
It's absolutely necessary, not just for the legislators' benefits, but I feel a very deep commitment to the people that come in and work in this building. And the fact that we have folks come in and say, if you have a fire on the first floor, the way this thing is built is it's going to just skyrocket to the fourth floor. Not to mention that we have pipes that are rotting out in the building. You can't get hot water in most parts of the wings, and we have people who come in, visitors who spend time in the building, and people who spend their careers working here that have to work in those kind of conditions is absolutely pathetic. So thank goodness for commission to help us with this.
Thank you for your support. We'll have something back to you and for next session.
It's not very often we get the chief of staff before us, and so I want to put my two cents in. I think you're exactly right, colleagues, on making sure that we look at what upgrades are needed in this building. I hope we'll look at technology as well.
Absolutely.
And while we're doing that, making sure that we're preserving the historic integrity of this building. Mm-hmm. The second one, and this is, since a freshman, this has been my pet peeve, and I guess it's my chance to share that. I hope the committee will also look at staffing issues for the legislature. When you take a look at a traditional co-chair or a traditional chair of revenue, the workload placed upon them is tremendous, not only in terms of what they have to deal with in their committees, but also the constituent outreach that is enhanced. When you're a co-chair, you have the same level of staffing. Set aside the fiscal staff, but you're receiving correspondence from the entire state of Oregon. And if you're trying to be responsive in the handling of that communication, it's almost physically impossible to do that. I know as a sub-chair, I just have a fraction of what other committee chairs have, and it's tough trying to keep up with the communication that we receive, not just from the district, but from a statewide perspective. And I hope you folks will just at least take a look at that issue and say, you know, are we making sure that Oregonians are getting the response they need through the assistance that legislators have available to them. So,
I assure you, Mr. Chairman, that the staffing levels, staff structure are already on the list and will be primary target. And you also will be solicited, each of the legislators will be solicited for your input as far as those items you want us to specifically take a look at. The list is a growing list. It's going to be a major project to take care of all of the suggestions, but we're getting structured to take care of it.
Well, I think the state of Oregon is very fortunate to have you and Judge Pryor at the lead on this, and I'm sure that
the
product is going to be just absolutely exceptional. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1084.
Representative Krupp moves Senate Bill 1084 to the full House Special Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Krupp, would you carry this one?
Be happy to, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Krupp is going to carry Senate Bill 1084. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1084, and we're now going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 480 relating to tax compliance. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have before you Senate Bill 480B with proposed Dash 13 amendments. The B engrossed bill would direct the Department of Revenue to establish and promote a voluntary compliance initiative for taxpayers who use listed transactions to underreport personal income or corporate income or excise taxes. The bill would also direct the department to establish a general tax amnesty program. The proposed Dash 13 amendments would remove sections 1 through 19 of the B engrossed bill, which deal with the listed transactions in voluntary compliance initiative, but retain the remaining sections relating to the general tax amnesty program. The general tax amnesty program would be conducted between July 1, 2006 and September 30, 2006 and would waive penalties for those who participate in the program. The bill would also impose a post-amnesty penalty of 25% against those who are eligible but did not participate. Mr. Chair, the bill would have a $625,000 general fund impact to the Department of Revenue in 05-07 and would require that the bill be amended to include language for that appropriation.
Thank you. It's our distinct pleasure to have Mr. Warner before us. Welcome. I'm going to use a prerogative of the chair, and I hope your time will allow this. Can you walk through the various sections of this bill and perhaps take a step-by-step through this so we all have a thorough understanding of what's before us?
I can do that, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill, I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. Senate Bill 480 has had both the House and the Senate, actually originated from the Senate Revenue Committee, have spent a great deal of time on this, so it has been something that the revenue committees have invested a lot of time and effort in working. And there's really two bases for it, as Tom laid out. There are the two components. One is the voluntary compliance initiative, and that's laid out in the bill as the initial portion of the bill. And then there is a general amnesty program that you're probably more familiar with because it has a lot longer history. The bill, as it came over from the Senate, had a number of other elements in it as well, particularly involving additional withholding requirements on real estate purchases, for example, and actually had a number of elements that were contained in a House bill, 2487. Most of that was removed in the House Revenue Committee. So you really have just the two main elements. It was the voluntary compliance initiative and the general amnesty. The voluntary compliance initiative has grown out of efforts really initially by the Internal Revenue Service. It started about 5 years ago. And what really generated interest from the states has been the experience of California. California instituted a voluntary compliance initiative in 2003. Basically, the effort is to prevent and search out for abusive tax shelters. Abusive tax shelters are defined as those transactions that have no economic substance. So they're done exclusively for tax purposes. In other words, it'd make no sense to be done unless for tax avoidance. What the bill does, however, has more narrowly defined this in the House Revenue Committee and defined what are called listed transactions, which are listed in the Internal Revenue Code. And you can see reference there at the top of page 2 to the Internal Revenue Code section, so that those listed transactions that taxpayers have to report to the Fed, to the IRS, now have to be reported, if this were to become law, would have to report that to the Department of Revenue. The initial bill, as it came over from the Senate, also had some rulemaking authority for the Department of Revenue to expand on what were listed transactions, particularly to get at transactions that may be abusive at a state level, but not necessarily at the federal level. And what the House Revenue Committee did was, rather than try to give that kind of additional authority, instead it focused on what are called REITs and RICs, real estate investment transactions, regulated investment corporations. The reason for that decision was that this is where a good deal of the abusive tax shelter activity had occurred in California. In fact, of the dollars that came in the VCI in California, the corporate revenue, by the way, is about two-thirds personal, one-third corporate in the California VCI, but of that one-third corporate, nearly 50%, about 45%, involved these real estate investment trusts and these regulated investment corporations.
And I know I'm asking the wrong person, but perhaps you might know. Didn't this committee within the Department of Revenue budget already allocate additional dollars for staffing to address this issue?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. In fact, you can see reference to that in the revenue impact statement. But, yes, the Department of Revenue had a package to try to look at some of these willful avoidance, is what they called it in that package. And one of the benefits for states has been that the California has been very willing to share the information they've gotten in their efforts. So the department has that information. Of course, you've got a number of multi-state taxpayers who are, you know, in both paying taxes in both states. So that's given them a database that they can use to track through some of those transactions.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I clicked on that we had put some funding into that. Thank you.
So the essentially the idea behind I don't, certainly not implying that REITs are necessarily a abusive tax shelter. They're certainly legitimate activity. They're a way of funneling dollars in the real estate sector. They're a way of reducing the risk for investors. But what's happened in terms of state income taxes, they're also a way to disguise or hide where the dollars were originally earned. And so, of course, the temptation is to, in a high-income tax state like Oregon or California, you tend to shelter those dollars and show them as originating in states that don't have an income tax, like in Nevada, for example, or Washington. And that's essentially what's happened. And the reason for including that in the bill was that these are not really something the feds are interested in, because those taxes are being paid at the federal level, but they're shifted around geographically. And so that's where it becomes a state-specific issue rather than a federal issue.
So through the shifting of that, these organizations, and I'm not sure if they're corporations or LLCs, but these organizations then are picking the states that have the most beneficial tax structure and are shifting the burden.
Well, they're shifting where that income's reported from, right? And in terms of Oregon's income tax base, I mean, the concept behind Oregon's taxes are that we're trying to tax economic activity that occurs in Oregon. And so this is a means of shifting as to where that income is identified as originating from for tax purposes.
Are they currently shifting it legally, and we now just want to capture that income?
The shifting is in terms of where it's reported at. In terms of our tax code, we tax economic activity that occurs in Oregon. So in that sense, it's not legal. That in terms of Oregon tax law, if it's economic activity in Oregon, it should be taxed under Oregon's current tax law. The remainder of the first section of the bill goes on and describes what are called reportable transactions that must be, that again, part of the Internal Revenue Code, that are reported to the Internal Revenue Service, have to be also reported to the Department of Revenue. It goes in and lists some additional penalties that occur in the case of these listed transactions. And those penalties, there's a series of penalties at 20% each and a maximum penalty of 60%. We've looked at, for example, some of the other voluntary compliance programs. Illinois, for example, has a 60% penalty as well. So it's pretty similar to what we've seen in line in other states.
Yeah, Representative Croft. Thanks.
Paul, on page 5 under Section 11, in sub 2, it talks about a penalty equal to 100% of the amount of the gross income derived by the person in promoting a tax shelter. Is that still in the bill, or is that deleted?
That's in the bill currently. It would be deleted with the dash 13s. The whole first sections would delete the entire voluntary compliance initiative program. But the 100% penalty would apply to promoters of abusive tax shelters, and basically it's saying that there's no net gain for the promoter. That whatever earnings they would get from that would be taken away through a penalty.
Okay.
So there's no incentive. The idea is to eliminate the incentive completely from participating.
But we are eliminating that in the dash 13s or the B13s.
That's correct, Mr.
Okay, and so what replaces that?
In terms of
a deterrent factor, in terms of penalty?
Well, there would not be any additional tax law related to abusive tax shelters.
Whatever's in place
current
today
right.
is the penalty, and I would assume it's less severe than 100% of whatever you're earning.
Well, we don't have any specific statutes about promoting abusive tax shelters. So there would be nothing on the books. Now, there are those who would be penalized for, there are penalties on the books for not properly reporting taxes, but there's nothing specifically on the books aimed at promoters. And again, this is, most of this language that you see initially was developed in council based on California statute. So that was the initial model. And then, of course, there's a number of changes that has to be made to fit it into Oregon law.
Okay.
I'll just finish with the first section by referring to Section 13, which begins at the bottom of page 5. That's what establishes the VCI, as we call it, the Voluntary Compliance Initiative. And that's to be conducted between November 1 and January 31st. And what it is, you've defined these listed transactions. The bill would also give the Department of Revenue additional authority to go back up to 6 years. Under current law, they go back 3 years unless there's a federal audit going on. So this would give us some additional ability to go back through the 1999 tax year. The rationale for that is that we know, based on the California and other experience from IRS, that it was at the peak of the stock market bubble is when we got, you know, a real incentive to try to shelter this kind of income because capital gains were jumping so much. That's not as much true in terms of the real estate investment trust, because that's really the one strong investment sector we've seen in the last couple of years. But Section 13 outlines that program. It would be a 90-day period where anyone who's been involved in these listed transactions can come forward with no penalty in that 90-day period. And the no penalty time would there would be some interest due on those past returns. You'd file an amended return. The committee's talked a good deal about appeals, which are used in other states, and decided to go with just running through the normal amended return process. You could come in with the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, amend your return, and then if you thought better of it, you know, later, you could file another amended return.
What's the purpose of publicizing the Compliance Initiative?
The purpose of it is to make taxpayers aware. As I, you know, usually you do
both
have...
Of the initiative, not of the people coming in.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
So you're, yeah, you want to make people, and that becomes a much more important issue in terms of the general amnesty, where you're dealing with a lot larger number, but a lot smaller dollars per taxpayer.
How do you anticipate? I see public meetings. How are you going to get the word out to folks, especially if they're located in other states?
The Department of Revenue would have the, you know, would be responsible for doing that under the bill, but. The experience we've had in other states is the number of taxpayers is not that great. They tend to be very relatively sophisticated taxpayers, very high-income taxpayers. The California dollars per return were in the hundreds of thousands in terms of these VCIs.
We already know who these folks are.
We know who some of them are, and that's part of that willful avoidance program in the California. See, if you're a multinational or multi-state corporation and you came in under the VCI in California, then the Department of Revenue knows who you are. So the VCI would allow a period in which people could come in at no penalty, and then after that is completed, after the January 31st, then you have the new penalties imposed, up to 60%. If you look on my my revenue impact statement for 480B that I think you all have, which you have that? Okay. You can see how I've broken up the estimate on the VCI. I've estimated that about $24.3 million would be available. We think that $6 million has been identified as an estimate in the willful tax avoidance package that you have approved, so I don't want to double count that. So I subtract that out. Another half a million estimated to come in through the through new penalties that are imposed after January 31, and that would give you net general fund revenue of $18.8 million. Associated with a VCI alone. And so I point that out because of the dash 13s, of course, mean that those dollars would not be included in the forecast. These estimates are really based largely, I've had two main sources, one California, the other Illinois. Illinois, for example, brought in $135 million in their VCI. Which did not have any reference to the REITs and RICs such as 480 does. It would be more just a list of transactions only. So if you proportion that down, you get down close to about $30 million for Oregon size. Illinois' tax structure is a lot different. Their corporate is a lot higher percentage of their income taxes than it is for us. So they have a different mix. But that would get, but I think they're in the relatively the same ballpark in terms of the proportions. California brought in $1.3 billion in their VCI, but only about $350 million of that was through, came in that was not on appeal. In other words, the taxpayer said that they would keep their appeal rights. So when I did the original estimates from California, I didn't include those dollars. I only included those that came in without appeal. And use that for my estimate. So in that sense, I think it's a conservative estimate. But, you know, to be honest, these are, you know, we don't have any real good data and background on this. I mean, we're shooting in the dark in terms of what kind of response we would get. And I would say that if 480B were to pass as is without the dash 13s, that, you know, I think there is definitely some upside potential there in terms of the amount of revenue
so,
that would come
so
in.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Cross.
Paul, with the B-13s, what does this bill really do?
With the B-13s, the bill starts with the General Amnesty Program, which is on page 11. And, you know, the tax amnesty program is something we're a little bit more confident about in terms of the estimates because so many more states have done it. 40 states have had a general amnesty going back over the last 25 years. Oregon has not participated in that for various reasons. It was discussed seriously in the mid-80s. Again, in the special session, some of your colleagues were quite interested in it in the 2002 special session. The decision had been made in the past to improve the Department of Revenue's compliance efforts and to do that rather than have a general amnesty. So this would be Oregon's first general amnesty program if this bill passes with a dash 13 or in current form or with a dash 13.
And Mr. Chairman,
please follow up.
Paul, that it is estimated that that will cost us $625,000 out of the general fund, or it will cost us in terms of income coming in, or it will cost us $625,000 to administer the program.
Representative Krupp, that's to administer the program. If you look on my revenue impact statement, the decision has been made both by Senate Revenue Committee and adopted by House Revenue Committee just to limit eligible participants to those who have not been identified by the Department of Revenue. If you've been issued a notice of deficiency, then you can't come into the amnesty. So you have to be somebody that's unidentified. And that's been a big debate about that. A lot of states do it. Our analysis suggested you may pull some money forward if you allow greater participation, but you're just going to lose it next biennium because you already know who they are. So that was the reason behind the decision. There's very little, we think very little net gain over two or three biennia, although you would gain maybe $3 to $4 million net in the current biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Please follow up.
So then with the B-13 amendments in regarding the VCI program, what net gain is there to the state, if any?
We've estimated that there's going to be about $12.9 million from unidentified taxpayers that will come in. This program would start on July 1 of 06. So that's an estimate. I've really based it primarily on Michigan's 2002 experience. One of the main reasons is they had real good presentation of their data, so I was able to break it down into detail, and that's was an estimate of their personal income taxes. We assume that about $3.2 million would be collected anyway, that those people are being out there identified on a regular basis. And I've added about 0.3 from new, though that 25% post-amnesty penalty, that's a net of 10.1. So the revenue impact of this bill with the dash 13s is plus 10.1. Without the dash 13s, it was plus 28.9. So that's the difference.
Can we go back to Section 3 really quick? It talks about, it makes reference to any person. When I read this, this tells me that folks who are going to be involved with a company that does business of this nature, they have a fiduciary responsibility to protect themselves and their company by being aware of what they're involved in. The notion of, I didn't know, that protection really goes away with this language. Is that?
Well, I
what
think
am I
there
missing
is,
here?
There is some language in the bill that, for example, under Section 6, a penalty may not be imposed if it's attributable to reasonable cause, good faith with respect to the underpayments, and so forth. And you do see some additional language toward the end of the bill as well, which was actually in another bill that was adopted into this. So there is discretion on the part of the Department of Revenue to make the case that there was good faith effort and not a recognition that this was an abusive tax shelter.
I understand the financial penalty part. Is there any type of, can you walk through this committee? Is there a criminal penalty?
We do have some criminal penalties on the books. They have been used virtually, have not been used, basically, in my understanding. So this bill does make reference to waiving criminal penalties during the VCI period and during the general amnesty period. But my understanding is that has been used very, very seldom.
How come only 90 days for the amnesty?
Well, that is a question the Revenue Committee's debated. One thing we do tend to see is most of the money comes in right at the end. So are you, if you extend it out, or you're just, postponing it up until that deadline? So the other thing is to keep in mind that, and I'm sure the Department of Revenue will testify to this, they've got to maneuver and move their staff around. Not as much with the VCI, but the general amnesty is much more labor-intensive for them. So that's, in fact, why the amnesty isn't scheduled until July 1, because they've got to go through the processing season, and so their resources are dedicated to just normal collection of the income tax before they can turn their attention to that.
If we're trying to get voluntary compliance, and we're dealing with the most sophisticated of the sophisticated, aren't they going to need a period of time to evaluate their financial situation and to determine whether this alternative makes sense or whether it even applies to them? Are we going to have upfront education or upfront public notice to let them know this is coming? The window of opportunity is here, and you'd better pull the trigger and act or not.
Well, I think that certainly that was one of the issues that was discussed. Again, I think the timing is more around the Department of Revenue's use of resources, because they're going to be, you go into February is when you're starting to send out refunds. So the intention was to, that window in terms of the department was to bring them to establish the VCI before that period starts. We do think that, again, it's sophisticated taxpayers. The California experience is pretty widely spread among the states, and we are seeing a number of states. New York, for example, now has established a program, and so we think that among sophisticated taxpayers, it's becoming pretty widely known, and they certainly know what a listed transaction is, because the IRS has defined that, and that's been in the IRS code for a number of years.
Have you looked at the opportunity cost of loss of revenue versus other benefits the state gains by having these folks do business in Oregon, just so we know what that cost is?
Mr. Chair, I don't think the idea is, if you look at theoretically what the abusive tax shelter is, it's an activity that has no economic substance. So I guess we're assuming there's no productivity going on. And keep in mind that there's a big difference. And I know there's a spectrum here, but certainly not suggesting actions that are intended to reduce tax liability, because we all do that. We all use municipal bonds or those kinds of things. Obviously, preferential tax treatment is a factor in that decision. So these are designed to be, and based on the IRS code, activities that would clearly not take place. The only reason they would take place would be to avoid taxes.
I've got two.
Representative Lockyer.
Thank you. Mr. Warren, you touched on this, but if you could talk a little more about the rationale behind eliminating the Department of Revenue's rulemaking authority to define the type of transactions that this bill would be applicable to.
Representative Vakian, that was an issue that was discussed certainly at length in the Senate. The Senate made the decision just because we know that there is an evolutionary process going on here in terms of what may be transactions available. And it was included in 480A. House Revenue talked about, in particular, the uncertainty to taxpayers as to what might turn out to be listed under department rules, and a general concern about how that would actually be implemented and put in place. And that was the rationale behind the House's decision. There was discussions with the Department of Revenue, and the decision was made rather than kind of give a general rulemaking authority to focus on where we know, based on the experience of other states, where we know a lot of this activity has occurred, and that's around the REITs and RICs. And that was to give more certainty and give the department clearer direction.
I don't need you to comment on this, but, Mr. Chair, it would sure seem to me that if something like this went forward, that you would want your state's experts in tax compliance, which lie within the Department of Revenue, to have the ability to use their expertise in order to create the targeted list. And so this just certainly seems contrary to the most beneficial way to do this, in my mind. And then the second question is, there's some folks that that believe that you can get a quick hit off this type of a process and bring in a good deal of money, but that over time you stand the risk of changing the culture of tax compliance so that folks figure out that that you can put off paying your taxes, get amnesty later, and pay later, and that actually becomes the new method of tax compliance from the taxpayers, and that with that you end up both with a more unreliable way of projecting your revenue stream, and then second, stand the risk of even decreasing your revenue stream from some segments in society. What's your opinion about that?
Well, again, that is something that both revenue committees spent a good deal of time talking about. Not so much in terms of the VCI, because that's a relatively new phenomenon, and I think the rationale behind that was the states were responding to developments that had occurred. But it was talked about a good deal more in terms of the general amnesty and what kind of message is being sent to the very large percentage of people who make an honest effort to calculate their taxes and get them in on time. What message does that send? And it is ultimately a voluntary system. I mean, that's the only way it's going to work, because the cost, if everybody was determined not to pay their taxes, the cost of compliance would make it prohibitive. So there was a lot of discussion, concern about that, and it's, in fact, one of the reasons Oregon has not gone the amnesty route in the past. We're in a bit of a unique situation because of our income tax dependence, and that really gives us that strong connection with the federal code, because we know people are paying both. Most states will go into a amnesty program, and you do tend to get a lot of times good response on sales taxes, because you can get lumps of money from taxpayers who, you know, businesses basically have not been remitting those sales taxes, and then realize this is an opportunity to catch up. So we haven't had that incentive that other states with sales taxes have had. I do think it is important to continue to send the message that tax compliance will be a long-term priority. That was the rationale behind the increased penalties. And I think it would have to be clear that this would not be something that would be done on an ongoing basis. And we have had states that have now had three amnesties over the last 20 years. So.
I want to make sure I understood what you just said, which is we want to make sure that this is not something that happens on an ongoing basis. What's the what in that? That this is what?
Well, that there's some kind of pattern of amnesties every 10 years or.
Well, tell me this, since you're our revenue officer, are there some red flags being raised in your mind with regard to this type of a system? Do you have some concern about the reliability of our revenue stream if we institute this?
I think we have a lot of experience and evidence to go on based on other states. I would say the answer to that, short answer, would be no for one amnesty. But I think if you were to turn around and have another amnesty in, say, 6 or 8 years, then I think you would begin to run a real risk of sending that message that, you know, we're going to do this periodically, so all you got to do is wait us out. We've had a number of states that have had three amnesties.
Does this bill limit it to the one-time shot, or does this set up something that could turn into a pattern?
This bill itself sunsets so that, you know, it's a one-shot revenue source, but it would not prevent a future legislature from coming forth and saying it. And, of course, what happens, and what's happened in some of these, is if you get revenue above expectations, for example, if you beat the estimates and there's additional revenue that comes in, it does become a temptation when you have a revenue shortfall to look at it again. So I do think that is the risk, would be to establish a pattern, and then you would have some long-term negative effects on compliance. We don't have hard evidence that one amnesty is going to have a measurable negative effect. We do not have that kind of evidence.
Thank you. I think I'm nearing the end.
No, this is good.
Is there evidence based on your research in other states that that doing more than one amnesty, where you have established a pattern over, say, a 10 or 20-year period, does in effect hurt your ability to have a reliable system?
Representative Bakken, I don't know of any, but I think, you know, over the next few years would be a time where we could start to look at that, because, you know, we've had the rounds, and you can, you know, all you got to do is look at the business cycle, and you can determine when the rounds of amnesties come. The 80s recession, early 90s recession, and the early 2000s recession. So you've had this period, and we've had states that have gone in with amnesties each of those 3 years. So that would be, within the next few years, we might see some evidence of how compliance has responded in those states.
Well, really quick, when I look at the general tax amnesty program on page 11, I'm reading this as an economic stimulus package almost for the state of Oregon, and I see it as a very positive small business bill. I'm not a tax accountant, but if you're a sole proprietor or a partner in a partnership or a member in an LLC and you're paying your personal income taxes and you're worried about a potential deficiency, this is an opportunity for you to step forward, to come clean, and to get yourself on the right track and to get your business on the right track. That's an accurate statement, I believe, isn't it?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's certainly true, that's the group where we do see some issues in terms of small businesses doing the tax planning and not recognizing some of the timing patterns that are required and getting behind for various reasons. So that would be a group we would anticipate would participate in this and may help to pull them out. Now, the advantage, and this is kind of the counter to the concerns raised by Representative Avakian, the advantage to the system is if these people are not in the system, they come in under the amnesty and now they're in. And they've in effect identified themselves. And in fact, I do anticipate some positive revenue from these folks going forward in future biennia, because now they're in the system and they will continue to pay. And there is some evidence that once you come in under an amnesty, you know, you will have tend to stay in at least for a while.
Well, I would hope every small business owner in the state would take advantage of this opportunity and get their business on track and use this as a learning experience, and hopefully never have to deal with these type of issues with the Oregon Department of Revenue again. I do see this, though, the more I read this. This is a very good small business bill and a very good economic stimulus package for the state of Oregon.
I would guess you could do an administrative rule or statute, too, that limits the amount of amnesties that a business or an individual could claim within a certain period of time, so that you don't have somebody who then adopts that as their method of tax compliance.
I think, you know, one thing I would point out is most small business owners don't want to be in the situation they're in and having to use this program. For most small business owners, it's a lack of understanding on how tax code works in the state of Oregon and in the federal government. They're very good at their skill. They're very good at their craft. They know how to make the best widget. They don't know how to do the books. And all of a sudden, the fear of the unknown takes over, and rather than stepping up to address the issue, they step back, and the issue just compounds on itself. And so I see this as a real opportunity to help those folks. I hope the Oregon Department of Revenue will also see it that way and will not only work small business owners through on this issue, but they'll take the initiative to help small business owners understand how to avoid this situation in the future. I see this as positive. Representative Bakken?
Since you're inviting.
Yep.
I see it as very positive for small businesses, too. I agree with everything that you said. I just think we have to be very careful that, especially for the mega businesses,
that this doesn't become a means of putting off tax liability and avoiding penalties at the same time. And that concern, in my mind, is almost equal to what I see as a great benefit for the small business sector.
That's very fair.
Walk through one other part I misunderstood. If a small business owner thinks they're doing everything correctly but wanted to use this as an opportunity to ensure they are, could they make application and come in and have their books reviewed? Not that that's likely, but is there an opportunity?
Yes, they could, and they would establish an they could establish an installment payment program too. So I believe it's up to 3 years to pay whatever liability they
would they be eligible for a refund if they came in, had the review done, and they found out that money was owed to them?
I don't think this would preclude that. No,
there is the potential a business owner could actually that they could actually garner additional money back.
And of course, the penalties get large for not reporting. That's where you get the big penalties,
right.
And that can be up to 100% for 3 years. After 3 years, so that would be the biggest incentive. Would be you know that you wouldn't have that penalty if you came in during the program.
This is a small business owner's one shot to get on the right track and to take advantage of this. And if they're truly interested in the long term success of their business. Hopefully pride will be set aside and they'll come in and take advantage of it. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments on this?
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill. I think under our narrative...
I'm gonna hold off on moving yet. I have a meeting scheduled later this morning where I'm going to work through some ideas on this still, and so I want to make sure we're all on the same page before I move forward.
Okay.
If that's all right. So, is there anyone else who would like to, in the audience? I know we're in work session, but I'd like to provide the opportunity for folks to come up and share their thoughts on Senate Bill 480. Mr. Warner, thank you very much. That was fabulous.
Yeah.
So, let's see.
Oh, come on up. Come on up. I apologize for that.
You could come up and just share with us your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I have a lot to add to what Mr. Warner said, but I do want to talk just briefly about the BCI from our perspective and maybe just clarify a couple of things, how we view this as operating. In both revenue committees, I heard testimony that this bill would take what are essentially legal transactions and turn them into illegal transactions. We don't view this bill as doing that. The transactions were either legal or illegal when the taxpayer entered into the transaction. And I think Mr. Warner helped make that point, that these are abusive transactions with no economic substance. They would not be done except for the tax savings, and that's the type of transaction that we're talking about here.
I want to be clear. When you use the word abusive, does that mean it's illegal?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would say that it is an illegal transaction if it is an abusive transaction. The only motive for engaging in the transaction was to avoid tax. No other reason, no business purpose, no economic substance to the transaction, simply to avoid tax. And specifically to the REITs and the RICs, Mr. Warner mentioned that we've received information.
I
want to
step back really
I'm
quick.
Sorry.
I apologize on this. We're new to this issue, and so we're a few seconds behind in our thinking. Every Oregonian is going to look at opportunities to limit the amount of money that they contribute to this. They're going to work to reduce their tax liability. What separates... I just want to be clear that what we're talking about are illegal transactions, not aggressive reductions in your tax liability.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it would help if I worked just through an example of
please,
what we
please, thank
okay.
you.
Real estate investment trusts were designed by Congress to encourage small investors to participate in real estate markets. For example, they're building condominiums in Portland now. You look at that and you say, boy, what a great investment that would be if only I had $30 million, which you don't have. Well, perhaps you do. I don't know. I don't have it. But if I have $30 or $300, I can put it into a real estate investment trust that pools money from a lot of individual investors and makes the investment and then shares out the earnings. That's the type of thing Congress intended when it enacted the laws relating to real estate investment trusts. What some businesses have done is look at the letter of the law and say, all right, we can use that, and here's how we can use it. Let's set up 99 nonprofit entities. We'll give each one of those a share in this real estate investment trust. We'll keep the other 99% of it. We'll transfer our corporate building into the real estate investment trust, and that trust will be out of state. Now we've accomplished two things. We've moved billions of dollars of property out of Oregon, so when you do your apportionment of corporate income, less comes to Oregon. Plus, we've changed the character of that, and now the income that comes back to the corporation from the real estate investment trust is 80% tax-free. That's the type of thing that we're seeing when we're talking about abusive tax shelters.
Is that currently illegal?
It is illegal because it was not, it has no economic substance. All of this is taking place on paper. The only reason the corporation did that was to avoid tax. The building is still here physically. Nothing has changed except that they have shifted property and income on paper outside of Oregon. So that's the type of thing that we talk about with abusive tax shelters.
So what we're saying is if you're going to do business in the state of Oregon, you're going to pay your fair share.
Chairman, I believe that's what the legislature has said.
I think that's what we're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the type of thing, the difference between a legal and an illegal transaction. That transaction was illegal when it occurred. This bill doesn't change it. What this bill says is, look, if you did that, here's an opportunity to come in and pay the tax that you should have paid.
Got it.
If you hadn't done it,
thank
you won't have
much.
Any penalties that apply to that transaction. Come in, pay the tax, the interest, and you're done. So that's what this bill would do. And then on a going forward basis, if corporations engage in those types of transactions and they don't report them, they just have to report it. Put up a red flag and say, okay, we've got this transaction going on. Do you want to look at it? If they don't report it and there is a deficiency in tax later, then additional penalties apply.
Well, I'd like to send the message then based upon an earlier comment I heard that, the message ought to be to folks who are engaging in this type of activity, now's your opportunity to come clean and to pay what you should have paid in the past. And keep in mind that this committee put additional dollars into the Oregon Department of Revenue to deal with these complex trust issues to ensure that in the future these situations don't occur again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A very good point, and that is what we are doing with that policy option package.
Here's your
we
chance.
Are looking at those.
If not, the state of Oregon is serious about this, and we put dollars into making sure the administration behind it is taken care of.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Bakian.
With your hypothetical you just gave us where the person did something illegal but comes back, can pay their taxes, and get no penalty. Does the department think that that's a good policy step for us to make, or is that a policy step that they are concerned about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Avakian, we leave the policy decisions to you. We think with this abusive tax shelter program, It does seem to be a bit different than a general amnesty. We have in the past had concerns about a general amnesty program for the reasons that you raised, that taxpayers may think this is now a new way of paying their tax, or that they will have an incentive not to comply voluntarily because Joe down the street didn't pay. He got away with no penalty when he finally got around to filing during an amnesty period. So we have had those concerns. The abusive tax shelter program we see as being somewhat different, and that because it does involve transactions where there may be differences of opinion as to whether or not they're legal, this does give them an opportunity to say, all right, we've we've decided that we shouldn't have done that. Here's the
okay,
tax.
Okay, you're giving me a very good answer, as you should, but let me preface the question again, because, you see, I, you know, for 15 years have been a civil rights lawyer, and, you know, have been one competently, done a fine job. But I have sitting right in front of me here someone who's an expert on the revenue side and tax compliance and from a separate branch of government yet. And certainly the legislature is going to craft policy and we're going to tell you what we think you should do. But I tell you, it would be a great benefit to me, who has never tried to hold somebody accountable for their taxes like you all do, to hear from you whether you think that I'm doing the right thing in creating a policy that's going to affect that. And frankly, I haven't ever gotten a good direct answer from anybody in your agency in a hearing as to whether or not you think we're doing the right thing. That just seems a little odd to me, that you would just rely on me with my civil rights legal background to make the decision on how I'm going to hold the folks accountable for their taxes. I don't know. Are we doing the right thing, or are we doing something we shouldn't be doing? Or do you want to just pass on that question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Avakian, would it be good enough if I said I would never tell you you were doing the wrong thing?
We get a lot of that.
I can't get past the you all part. I'm having influence on you.
Yeah, sorry.
You all.
My Bartlesville, Oklahoma upbringing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawking, I think what we do feel is that it's important to do something in this area, that it is a growing area, and in fact the Multi-State Tax Commission, which we are a member of, is looking at this now to develop uniform language for the states and a uniform policy that can be taken to the legislatures in the states. So
okay, so that's interesting. So you've got a group of certified smart people in revenue collection that are already looking at this and trying to craft a good way to do it, but we've stepped out there with a bill and are doing something that might or might not be the same.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Avakian, they are looking at it. I don't know how long it's going to take them to develop. Certainly it's going to be after the end of this session.
Would the department... Okay, that was fine. We're getting there. Would the department have concerns about the legislature eliminating your rulemaking authority and defining what kinds of transactions you should be going after?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Avakian, as Mr. Warner mentioned, that authority was taken out on the House side. We did not express concerns about that. We think what is in the bill relating to the two transactions that are defined in the bill is very helpful at this point. And beyond that, I think what would happen is, as we identify transactions, we will come back to you and say, here's an additional transaction that corporations are starting to engage in. Would you like to stop that? Do you have concerns about it? Do you want to give us some assistance in that area?
And the agency is comfortable with coming back to us for authority rather than having it on your own?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, yes, we are comfortable.
You've been a very good sport with my facetious comments.
Thank you.
And I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the B-13 amendments. I don't have a copy of them.
They're in your packet.
Are they in our packet?
They're in
I apologize.
They're not going to help you much just to look at.
They really are. There's not much there, Mr. Chairman.
No.
It's this memorandum here. That's it.
Okay. Have you had a chance to look at these?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did look at those.
What's your thoughts on these?
Mr. Chairman, the amendments simply delete the voluntary compliance initiative from the bill. So the things that we have talked about with abusive tax shelters, listed transactions, reporting, going back, all of that would be irrelevant.
Okay, so the first part of the bill becomes irrelevant.
Yes.
And really what we'd be dealing with is simply the general tax amnesty
yes,
program.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
But Mr. Chairman, there is, if I recall, Director Warner's, or not Director, but Paul Warner's testimony was that there is still a VCI. There isn't at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, okay. all of that is eliminated.
Everything's still eliminated.
Okay.
Which I would take, given your previous testimony, as something that would concern the department.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, what we would be doing then is using current law, what we have existing now as far as our ability to enforce abusive transactions. And there is a penalty on the books now for substantial understatement of income. It is a 20% penalty. It would not apply if the taxpayer has reported the income and simply engaged in transactions that somehow move it out of state. At least I don't think it would apply. So in addition to that, we would have a shorter statute of limitations to address.
The department favors the bill without the amendment rather than with the amendment. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Avakian, if...
That's for us to decide, I think.
It really is. It's your policy choice. Do you want to have a program with addressing abusive tax shelters or simply a general amnesty program? We will do either.
May I, for just a minute?
Of course.
And I'm really not picking on you. This is a very complicated bill. And I want to know from the state's experts what is the best way to enable you to go get the money. And I can't even get an answer as to whether the amendment helps you do that or not. I don't know which is the best method for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, if your goal is to bring in revenue, and if you're asking me what does that, the bill without the dash B13 amendments brings in more revenue than if you adopt the amendments into the bill.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. May I?
Please, of course.
That aside, does the department see any benefit to us adopting the amendments in enabling you to do your jobs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, no.
Okay, thanks. Done.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have one or two more questions, and we are going to move on. If I'm an average Oregonian who has a little extra money and I want to invest in a real estate trust, how do I remain an investor and not an accomplice if something's going on?
Well, let's step out and talk to your lawyer before we get into that question.
Are you offering free legal advice or hanging out your single?
I was going to go get question. Hendrix.
It's a fair question. How do I as a trust member, I'm not sure if it's a member or owner, as a member of a trust who... you know, is one of the 99, not the one. How do I keep myself out of this issue?
Mr. Chair, that is a very good question.
Can you maybe think about that and get back to me? Because we're not going to move this bill right now. But I think there's a lot of people who perhaps could get pulled in on an issue for doing nothing more than making what they see as a personal strategic investment, not knowing, you know, the tax implications that the management group is finagling.
Mr. Chair, to that question, as a general rule, if the corporation is engaging in an abusive tax shelter, trying to get this set up so that they take advantage of the letter of the law, you probably aren't going to be involved in that as an individual just out on the street somewhere. It's going to be set up inside the corporation, and it won't involve you. If you're making a legitimate investment in a legitimate real estate investment trust, you're going through a broker or some other entity that, like you do a mutual fund.
Right.
And you won't be pulled into that. But
what if it's a significant investment? I hit the lottery. I don't gamble, but I hit the lottery, and I pick up $250,000, and I choose to invest in one of those apartment complex scenarios you mentioned. And now, you know, I'm a 30% owner in it. Again, an investor.
But that is likely a legitimate investment and not an abusive tax shelter. The abusive tax shelter would be the corporation that transfers its own business into a paper real estate investment trust and then the income is coming to the corporation. It's not out there looking for investments from individual investors.
Oh, I thought it was
it's
the corporation that set up the trust to do the investment.
It is, but all of that is occurring on paper, and they're not out there looking for individual investors. Now, what we have seen is where charitable organizations are finding themselves as unwitting accomplices because they may be given one share of that real estate investment trust, so it meets the threshold number of shareholders, and they find that they're perhaps pulled into this unwittingly, and they have been cooperating with investigations on that. But you as an individual investor probably are not going to be pulled into one of these. That's just my guess.
Well, here, colleagues, just so you know where I am on this issue, I'm strongly supportive of the general tax amnesty program. Again, I see this as very positive for Oregon and for small business. On the other piece, the voluntary compliance initiative, I want to study this a little further, make sure I understand this. This is very complex. And I think we owe Oregonians, we owe it to Oregonians to make sure we understand exactly what we're proceeding forward with. And so I'm going to hold up on this. So I appreciate your comments. And with that said, we are going to close the work session on Senate Bill 480. And we're now going to go into what I hope are some more fun bills, bills that we've all been waiting on. And I'm going to go first to House Bill 2795. For who? For who?
Turn off the eligible staff after we're done.
Dallas.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of this committee. House Bill 2795 is an appropriation to the Director of Veterans Affairs of $100,000 to help fund an Afghan-Iraqi conflict memorial out here in the mall by the Veterans Affairs Building. This is part, an integral part of the military benefits package that both chambers have agreed upon. Both chambers have agreed upon on this bill. And here it's part of the House plan, and
we'll just move it
as is. The remaining benefit, the remaining part of the package has to do with benefits for veterans and members of the National Guard, and they're still kind of coming to agreement on the dollars there. So you will see those packages come. There'll be a Senate package and a House package. Each will have a program bill and then an accompanying appropriation bill. But this one is mutually agreed upon to move as is.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2795 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Terrific. Representative Babaki moves House Bill 2795 to the House Special Committee on Budget with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank the Kestersons, Clay and MJ, for showing up today, and Director Willis. As you know, Clay and MJ have been really the driving force behind the Afghan-Iraqi War Memorial. And for the obvious reason, they lost their son, Eric, a helicopter pilot in Iraq. But fortunately, his daughter is right here. My apologies. And MJ just went back to Pennsylvania, isn't it, to pick her up. She's out spending the summer with them. And so appreciate Director Willis in here. This is a good thing. And glad you guys continue to show up and show support for what we're doing here.
I'd like to say thank you as well. I know that this, it seems like this has taken a lot to get to this point, but that's part of what you folks fought for, and that's democracy and working through this process. I see this as truly a token of thank you to what you given to the state of Oregon and to this great nation. Mr. Director, thank you for all you do in making sure that these issues stay on the front burner. You do a fabulous job. And so with that, seeing no other discussion, we are going to pass House Bill 2795. And ask Representative Krupp if he would take the lead on this bill and
be honored to.
And I'm going to, because Representative Nelson and Representative, help me here, Boquist. Thank you. Have also played key roles in helping to advance the Veterans Memorial forward. I'm gonna ask if Representative Krupp would coordinate with them to make sure their thoughts are shared with us on the floor as well.
And it's Representative Nelson's bill, and we certainly want to make sure that she has an opportunity to be co-carrier of the bill.
Thank you. So, and I guess my last parting comment is issues like this that aren't Republican, they're not Democrat. These are Oregon issues, and once again, thank you for all you do. So, with that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2795, and we are going to open up a work session on House Bill 2601.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee.
Have a great day.
House Bill 2601 is, we've heard testimony and passes, an appropriation of $1 million to fund the Gresham Center for Performing Arts. I believe it's Performing Arts. Gresham Center for the Arts. And the House Committee, part of the House plan, provides $100,000 in lieu of $1 million. I prepared a memo to you on Friday and had the amendment in there on the back of the memo. Over the weekend, the plan changed slightly from a general fund support of $1 million. It's on the reverse side of my memo.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. The plan now is to provide $100,000 in lottery fund for the support of the Arts Center instead of $1 million general fund, or then it's shifted to $100,000 general fund. So it would be. I would ask for your approval to amend the bill to $100,000 of lottery fund, and I'll make sure the necessary amendments get drafted.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee adopt the amendment.
Okay.
And I'll do it all together. Yeah. And in doing so, pass House Bill 2601 onto the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Okay. Representative Avakian moves House Bill 2601 with the addition of the conceptual amendment, changing general fund to lottery for the same amount of $100,000. His motion is to move it to the full House Special Committee on Budget.
I concur.
Any other discussion?
With the due pass recommendation.
With the due pass recommendation. Yeah, so moved. Representative Babakian, would you?
I would accept that you grew up in Gresham. And
are you okay with that? I like to spread the...
I am happy with you. You told such nice stories about all the hooliganish things you did running around Gresham
there
as a
go.
Kid. And you could
I
do
can't
it.
Imagine the chairman being a hooligan, but that's so.
Trust me.
No, I'd be happy to carry that.
Okay.
And on the floor.
Why don't we give it to
Representative
Lim on the floor?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. What I'm going to do is not adjourn, but recess for the day until I figure out how we need to proceed forward with the
1084.
You need 480. 480. Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
With 480. What I will share with you is I'll come visit with you folks before. We determine what we're thinking about in terms
Mr. Chairman,
of thoughts and notes.
Representative Avakian, what time are you leaving?
Not till tonight. I'll be around.
Okay, you're around all day.
I'll be here till 6 tonight. So.
Okay.
Here's what I'm doing on Senate Bill 480. I'm asking for additional input on this. As I get that additional input, I will make sure that it's disseminated to both of you so you folks will have an opportunity to review it. And either I will call us back into work session today before 5. Does that work? Before?
Yeah, it should be fine.
Before 5, yeah. Or we will adjourn for the day and have to deal with this another day.
Either way, Mr. Chair, you will be back here.
Today?
Yes, because you got to come out of recess to adjourn.
I will be back here no matter what. That's that's why we have Dallas to keep me in line.
Except that if he comes back alone, he doesn't have a quorum.
Right.
That's right.
To adjourn. So do you want to...
I'll have to find one of you to come back.
Yeah, just make sure you come. Yeah.
Okay.
You
all right. Is that all right, Anne-Marie?
Sure.
Okay. So seeing no other business, we're going to recess. Piece of time.